Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 101, Buddhism 101, Defining Enlightenment.
I guess we have to like start from the beginning. We have to start with enlightenment. And to do that, I think we can sort of combine that with history. So what I thought I would do tonight is I would start with enlightenment, the beginning of Buddhism and the end of Buddhism, and then go something to the history of India and Tibet and how it got to be the centerpiece of Tibetan civilization, and then perhaps rehearse or go through the path so you can sort of get a view of what they think of as the path to enlightenment or the path of enlightenment. Beginning first with the Buddha. Now, Shakyamuni Buddha lived about 2,500 years ago, although nobody really knows exactly when, but the best guesses are about 2,500 years ago, roughly contemporary with the pre-Socratics, with Confucius, with a little later than Zoroaster, in North India, actually born in where he was born is currently Nepal, and he was a prince of who lived a very luxurious life as a youth. His father had received a prediction that his son would either conquer the world or he would become an enlightened, penniless sage. So the father decided he preferred the world conquest option and was told that in order to ensure that the world conquest option was what happened, he should make sure that Buddha wasn't unhappy about anything ever. Prince Siddhartha, his son, never got unhappy about anything. So he arranged things where Prince Siddhartha had a very, very happy life. And for his first 29 years, and he was happily married, and he had a beautiful son, and he was a master of all the arts of governing and the arts of war, because in those days a king had to be a warrior, had to lead armies, and was a general and organizer of people. And he excelled at all of these things, according to the story, the legend or the story. And but he had this tendency to be reflective, and he had this tendency to want to save lives rather than take lives. And this worried his father. And whenever the Buddha would be couldn't be found around the house, there would be big alarms sent out of where did he go. And because his father was afraid he would go into trance or attain samadhi or start becoming holy. And that was the last thing the father wanted. So however, Buddha finally did manage to break out of the palaces, the summer palace and the winter palace and the autumn palace. There are different versions of the story. The later ones are more elaborate than the earlier ones. And he finally broke out, though, and he saw, for the first time in his life, he saw an old person. He had never seen an old person. He'd only seen young and handsome and beautiful people. And he was shocked at this and said, "What is this?" And his charioteer told him, "Well, this is what happens to us all." That was a big shock to him. And then again he went out, he saw a sick person, which he'd never seen, because whenever anyone would get sick, they'd be taken away from his presence, and he would never had seen sick people, supposedly. And then finally he saw a corpse, a dead person, and that was a big shock to him. And last of all, he saw an ascetic, a wandering seeker of truth, what they called a shramana. In Sanskrit, a wanderer, a one who seeks refuge from the sufferings of ordinary living. And he felt that Shramana had a special light about him, which he was very happy about, because he had been truly concerned by sickness, old age, and death, and he thought there must be something, some way to do something about this type of thing, you know, and find out what is the cause of this, or how to escape from it, or how to protect people from it, or what have you. He'd been brought up as a kid to be a king, and he had been brought up thinking that his role in life was to protect people. And then he felt, however, that what good does it do to have a kingdom and a defense force and what have you, an economy, if everyone gets sick, grows old, and dies anyway? So when his father, when it came down to where, when his son was born, according to some versions of the story, in some only when his wife was pregnant, but anyway, when he was about to have a son, the father said to him, okay, now I'm going to, by the Hindu, by the Brahminical theory, then when you have a son, when you have a grandson, then you can retire from whatever you do, and then your son takes over whatever the family business is. So he said, okay, now you're going to have a son, and or now you've had a son, and now I'm going to retire from the kingdom, and you have to serve Siddhartha, and you have to run the kingdom. And Buddha said, sorry, Dad, you'll have to wait a little longer to retire. I'm going to myself retire to the forest. I'm going to become a seeker of enlightenment. And when I come back, I'll clue you in on it. And Dad said, what are you talking about? I don't want to be clued in on any such thing. I want to retire and take a break. And so then he did the thing that fathers will do in such circumstances, which is he had his son locked up. And but then, you know, the gods came in and intervened in the, you know, the mythical thing, you know. The gods wanted the Buddha to attain enlightenment, so they intervened and they helped him sneak out, which he did. Went out, and he meditated in the forest, and he spent 6 years studying with different yoga teachers, actually one by one rejecting their versions of the teaching of ultimate reality, but trying them out, and doing mortifying the flesh, sort of doing tremendous ascetical ordeals to sort of counterbalance his tremendous hedonistic luxury lifestyle of a young prince. At the end of that, he renounced doing that. He said, that's no good, all this mortifying of the flesh doesn't get you anywhere. And he went and sat down under a tree, and some goddess brought him a bowl of frozen yogurt from heaven, a heavenly frozen yogurt, and his body immediately filled out and his skin turned gold, and he was, and then all his friends who were the fellow mortifiers of the flesh were mad with him, and they left and said, he's a cop-out, the guy eats ice cream, you know, he's no good. And so he was all alone there, and he said, I'm gonna not move from this place. Even my bones can wither, whatever. I'm not going to move from here until I know what the meaning of life is, what is reality. You know, I'm going to discover that. So then he sat there, and it is said during the night, the first thing he remembered was all of his previous lives, infinite billions and millions of lives where he was all different kinds of animals, and he was a god, and he was in hells. And he remembered his infinite evolutionary past. And then he remembered, he became aware of all of the paths and future paths and pasts and futures of all the other living beings in the world. And then he was able to know all their thoughts. And then he was able to know all the different realms of the universe and so forth. And he finally, he came to a direct realization, at least this is the amazing claim on which Buddhism is founded. He came to a complete knowledge of the nature of reality, basically. He did not, in fact, you know, as religious prophets do, you know, he didn't meet God, or he wasn't invested with a mission by God, so to speak. He did not discover that there was an omniscient mind controlling the universe. He did not. He discovered himself the total knowledge of the nature of the universe. In other words, he made an exact experience, like he saw the atoms, how they worked. He saw subatomic particles. He saw far galaxies. He saw how the human mind and the human heart works, etc. He attained a virtual omniscience, and he then also, in that attainment, he also noted that there were millions, infinite numbers of beings in other universes. There were infinite numbers of enlightened beings. There were infinite numbers of gods and every kind of being. And he also became aware of that. So in a way, he did become kind of aware of a force of enlightenment and love in the universe, but not just, it wasn't something disconnected from the universe or out of the universe. It was perceived by him as the strong force, you could say, of the universe. And he was very happy, and it was said the earth quaked, you know, and all the deities came, and the devil actually came, Satan, which they call Mara, and some say the Buddhists invented Satan, actually, I don't know if you know that, but he was called Mara in India. And this Mara came there and tried to persuade him and tempt him and lead him astray, you know, and he wouldn't be led astray by Mara. And then Mara went to drat, you know, and went away like one of those silent movie characters. And so he had this whole thing. But the key of what he understood is not that mysterious. And so I want to start by letting you know kind of sort of basically what it is. And by definition, I don't pretend that I know what it is really, but in a really visceral way, but I can tell you by definition what it is. He discovered that the problem he had been having, and that all beings have, and that the cause of all the suffering in the world is misunderstanding, actually. It is misknowledge. People usually say ignorance, but it's not quite ignorance in the normal way we understand ignorance, in the sense that it's not just a failure to know something, you know, like some quantum of information. What it is, it's an actively wrong knowing of everything, a misknowledge of the world. And the essence of the misknowledge is the very simple one that we can all immediately understand. Here now in this room, every one of you knows for sure one thing, right? You're all children of Descartes. For example, you have it put for you perfectly, therefore you know that you are there, and you know who you are, right? If anybody for a moment didn't know who they were, you'd be nervous. You'd think something was wrong. And so you know, I'm me, I'm this and that, I can show you, I got a driver's license, I'm a human, I'm a this, I'm alive, I'm many things, and that's me, right? And you know that. And that is actually wrong in a way, unfortunately. Not completely wrong, but wrong enough to cause all of suffering. And in what way? And why does it cause all of suffering, you see? Because in a way you're totally shortchanging yourself. When you say you know who you are, you mean, of course, you as distinct from me and from everyone else. You as a sort of intrinsically real, sort of fixed thing that is always there to when you go, me, it lands on you. Right? It's like you're there. It's like a little, one of those little high school charm bracelets that says, you know, Bob on it or Annabelle, you know. It's like hanging somewhere in your soul, and that's you, and you know that that's you, right? And you know that that's not the rest of the universe. You know that. And no one else is you, right? And because you know that, you are in a completely impossible situation, aren't you? Because why? First of all, you know, subliminally, you don't like to think about it all the time, but you know that everyone else in here doesn't agree with you that you're the real thing here. And the main thing, each one of you also thinks that not only do you know who you are, but you know you're the main thing here. The fact that you came here is the most important thing that happened here. You know, you drove and you got the ticket and you came and you did it, and that, and you're really the real thing that's here. You're not sure. The other people could be cardboard dummies, you know. They could be holographic projections sent here by the mad scientists, you know. But you know you're here, and that's the main thing, right? But then you secretly know everyone else has the temerity to think that they're the main thing. And therefore, they kind of are contesting your centrality here and your importance. And they know they're real. They don't know even if you're real, you see. And so while things are nice and the weather is good and there's enough food and we're in a comfortable economy and there's no war and no Bosnia and no what have you, that's not too difficult. We have courtesy. We sort of pretend not to be thinking we're the main thing, and we sort of say, after you, and let me hold the door, and you first, and, you know, you have a share. And now and then we fall in love with someone and temporarily we think they're the main thing. Or we have a child and we think that, unfortunately, a little less temporarily, we have to deal with them being the main thing. But still, we then will revert to us being the main thing, and then the whole universe is therefore really on some deep level against us, and we are against the universe. And with us being against the universe, Buddha noted, he Buddha had been against the universe, it had been against him, and he realized that you lose when you are against the universe and it is against you. It is, the universe is time, and time makes you grow old, and you get sick, and you die. The universe is other people, and you can't contest with them forever. They will wear you out. And then death will come along, and you will die, and you will lose complete control when you die. And you don't know what will happen to you after that. You dream up many hopeful fantasies, but you don't know, and it's terrifying. And so all of this suffering comes from this situation of being you pitted against the world. Now, Buddha didn't just say, okay, that's a bad scene, so we'll just change it and we won't suffer, as if it was arbitrarily doable like that. That would have been useless. What he wanted to know was, the reason he went off to seek is that he wanted to know if this really is the situation. I think I'm me, I think I'm the main thing, but is that so? Am I the main thing? This was what he was out to discover. And what he discovered was, first of all, I want to say right away, he did not discover that he did not exist. That was not what he discovered. It's very important to make that, because people always misunderstand Buddhism to think that the big eureka, Buddha's big eureka was, wow, I'm so happy because nobody's home, you know. that would have really been an idiotic thing, you know. And the Indian people are very intelligent. And some guy jumps up and says, "Eureka, nobody's home." They would have said, "Then get lost. Well, why should we listen to somebody who doesn't exist?" So that was not what he discovered. Although he sometimes would say, basically, "I don't exist," or "You don't exist," or "I don't have a self." He would say that. "I have no self. My self doesn't exist. Your self doesn't exist." He would say it just to kind of shock us, in the sense that the way we think we exist, we don't exist in that way, as the main thing, as the central thing, as an unchanging, fixed thing apart from the rest of the universe, as an absolute thing even, we don't exist. That's what he wanted to kind of jolt us into being aware of. Because unfortunately, when our sense of self-importance, our egotism, our egocentrism, is based on a delusion, a miswiring in the core of our program, that we are something absolute about us, that we as personalities are absolute things, you see. And therefore, that then pits us in the sense against the absolute world, which is against us, right? So what he realized was that he didn't realize that he didn't exist. And he realized that his sense of himself as existing as an absolute thing was a mistake. And then he realized that between these two extremes of being an absolute self and being non-existent at all, a non-existent self, between those two extremes, there was a way of being a relational self, a pure nexus of relationship, totally interconnected with all other things and beings, in a sense not really different from the universe, not one sort of thing like the whole universe melting into a cosmic sludge or something, the way people wrongly think mysticism is a big thing of thinking the universe is all one big soup or something. That was not at all his vision. His vision was there is relative and relational differences, but ultimately these differences dissolve and there's kind of an ultimate unity. So there's ultimate unity and relational difference simultaneously present. And that made him really happy for some reason. Somehow the burden of being stuck with this absolute confrontation between your absolute self and the absolute other universe was just too much. The way he understood it, it is what really makes us tired. It is why at the end of 12 hours of waking consciousness, we can't wait to pass out and go to sleep and just not be there, because being sort of holding ourselves up against the universe somehow and all of the things and the stimuli and the ideas and the problems coming, it gets too tiring. Whereas when we know that we and the universe are sort of interconnected, our relative difference becomes much easier to bear. We can somehow deal with it. We somehow connect with it, you see. So that's basically it, okay? It's not very mysterious, you know? Isn't it? Isn't it simple? That's all enlightenment is, really. It is being connected, realizing your interconnectedness with all things, and realizing your relationality with all things, really viscerally realizing that. Because once you are not an absolute thing apart from things, then also, other beings become more preoccupied with others. What is there so great about yourself to be so focused on and self-preoccupied with all the time? The sort of root of narcissism and the self-preoccupation and what the Buddhists call self-cherishing dissolves in a certain way. You become transparent to yourself. Once you become transparent with yourself, you become bored with yourself. Because you sort of can see through yourself. You realize you are interconnected with others, and you also realize you are very fluid and flexible. And if you let yourself go, you can become more and more negative, and your states of being can become negative. If you cultivate yourself creatively to be a vehicle of love and compassion and joy, you can be infinitely loving and compassionate and joyful. Because you are a relational process. There's nothing fixated about you. So then this is called sort of the realization of wisdom and compassion. You know, wisdom comes from seeing through the self in a certain way. Not that you don't exist, but that you are relational, you are permeable, you are interconnected. And then compassion arises from that, because then you come to realize, as Shantideva says, that you and other beings are but the limbs of one life. And therefore, just like, for example, and that compassion is not some sort of sentimental and great saintly thing, it becomes a natural thing, just like when your hand touches heat, a hot object, or goes to the fire, you pull it away, and you don't say, "I'm so compassionate to my hand, not letting it burn in the fire." You just remove it from the pain because you feel the pain. So similarly, when you become transparent to yourself, all beings somehow become transparent to you, and you feel their feeling in this new way, though, of not so concretized. You feel it in a kind of virtual way where you can bear to feel it, but then you become committed to them not having bad feelings, which is called compassion, and you become committed to them having good feelings, which is called love. So if you take the analogy, so why Buddha was happy was, if you take the analogy of someone being happy when they're in love, you know, before something has gone wrong, you know, that time of being in love when your identification of self expands to incorporate the beloved, and even the beloved becomes the most important part of the self, in a sense. You want the beloved to be happy most of all. And there's this exhilarating, wonderful feeling of forgetting about yourself and really focusing on the beloved like a newborn child. It doesn't have to be romantic, only like a newborn child, the beautiful little thing, cutest little thing in the universe, right? We've all had them, held them in our arms, you know? But what happened to Buddha was when he became transparent to himself, every being looked like that beautiful child in his arms. Every being was like part of himself. His identity expanded to include the feelings and the hearts and the minds of all of the beings. And they all, he fell in love with all of them. And he was also encouraged that, just as now, by realizing his freedom from this absolute selfhood and finding tremendous joy and release in that, every single one of them was due to find that and could find it. They could learn it just as he had learned about it. They could learn, study themselves, study reality, concentrate, focus, develop, and eventually realize their own freedom from this imprisoning, distorted, absolutized selfhood. And through that freedom, then really feel real love for beings and universal love for beings and really achieve happiness. Is that clear? Good. So that's where Buddhism came from, that he had that experience. You know, as I wrote a paper a little while ago, it was published in a Notre Dame collection of philosophy things, entitled The Buddha's Smile. And this smile is what I have been getting grateful for more and more as I grow older, because the claim is, you see, not that I really can verify it or know it, but anyway, the claim is that Buddha attained this total exact knowledge of the nature of reality, and then he smiled. Imagine attaining the total exact knowledge of reality and going, oh no, what a bummer, you know, what an awful scene, you know, type thing. That would be worrisome, wouldn't it? But he smiled because he saw that the sentient condition was fixable. The sentient condition was really on the threshold, and especially the human condition amongst the different sentient forms, actually human and certain types of deity forms, certain types of gods or angels, or there's many different layers and levels of heavens in the Buddhist universe, many different gods and goddesses and angels and different things, and certain types of, certain of them are so sybaritic, they live in these like cosmic jacuzzis like a billion miles across with these diamond bodies and things, and they're just so like self-indulged that they're hopeless, they can't think of a thing until they die, which happens, takes billions of years, but some of them are a little more balanced, more like humanoid, and then they're able to reflect on these things and come to these understandings. So certain types of humans and gods have this wonderful capacity of becoming self-reflective and actually investigating, and this highly cultivated intelligence and imagination and empathy that they can actually achieve this wisdom and compassion. They have already, each one of them has evolved infinitely in the past to be able to truly achieve it. He saw that. So therefore he was optimistic. He smiled because he was happy, and he saw that beings could achieve that same happiness as he had. And then he felt that he would help them with it. But then he started out in a wonderful way. The first thing he said was to them was, well, not quite the first thing, but anyway, something that he constantly repeated was, don't necessarily believe me what I say. Yes, I did understand that I'm a Buddha. There is such a thing as a Buddha. If you feel maybe that there's some kind of different way of being in the world, that's good to inspire yourselves. But don't necessarily believe everything I say. Because if you believe what I say just because I look cute like I'm a Buddha, then you'll believe some idiotic thing some other person says who may be more cute. Because you don't really have a reason to believe what you believe. So don't depend on authorities, was the first thing he said. First he said, I know everything, but then don't believe what I say because then you'll become dependent on authorities. the real authority for you, because you are this marvelous being who has self-reflective awareness. The thing for you to depend on is the authority of your own experience, the authority of your own reasoning, the authority of your own heart. That's what you should, not that every prejudiced opinion in your heart is necessarily correct. You have to examine, you have to correct, you have to evolve and develop. But deep down, there's something in you that you can believe. And then you can take this and that and practice and try it and experiment. But then finally, you are the one to judge. Rely on yourself. He was very, very big on that. Because he had to do it himself. He had to go against what his father told him to do. He had to go against what the priest told him to do about be a king and stay in the world and do all this. You know, he had to get out of the chariot and go and seek this truth, this reality, this truth, in order to find his freedom, which, and then be able to share it with others. So he doesn't want to then impose that authority on others. That is the useful thing. So then he, how to help people get this? Well, he became a teacher. Actually, the most important name for Buddha in Buddhism is Shasta. And Shasta means teacher. And teacher is a very consciously chosen word. It is not a guru, not the word that was in India at the time, authoritarian or authoritative guru. It was Shasta, which means teacher, which means one who brings out, like our notion of a liberal arts teacher, one who brings out in the hearts and minds of others their own innate potential to understand themselves and their lives, to do something for others, to find the meaning of what they're doing, and to enjoy that, to enjoy the privilege of such a free and well-endowed human life form as we have. So a teacher is not an indoctrinator. A teacher is not an authoritarian enforcer of dogmas in this view, you see. And that was the most important name for the Buddha. So he needed to found a school. And there was, and he was I'm nervous because we have the president here, and I never like to tell this when there's university presidents around. But he realized that schools are very hard to fund, and that kings, the social authorities of the day, don't necessarily like schools that teach opening of the heart, that teach enlightenment. They don't mind trade schools. They don't mind military academies. They don't mind cooking schools for the ladies. But they don't want schools that will make someone realize their own true potential, because they realize then many people might not want to serve in the armies or the kitchens or the bedrooms or the wherever the different people have to serve, or the fields. So he was very clever. So he went to the kings and said, look, our guys don't want big salaries. I don't want a salary. I had a kingdom. I didn't want that. I'm not going back to it. I don't need a big fancy building. What we need is a free lunch. Every day we need one free lunch. We don't need a free dinner. We don't need breakfast. Just lunch. And then every time you give us a free lunch, we'll give you a little lecture, if you like. And the king said, that doesn't sound too bad. And so, great. So that was establishing the sangha, the monastic sangha. And then, oh, you, by the way, if you have like a little garden or a park or an old shed somewhere, we can stay there in the rainy season. And in the dry season, in the good weather, we can stay outdoors and camp in one of your gardens or groves or something. Just have people not bother us. And then we'll come in and we'll beg, and you give us lunch, free lunch. And then that's it. We won't own property. We'll be celibate. We won't procreate. We will just devote ourselves to enlightenment, and you guys will get the pleasure of giving lunch to us, and we'll give you a cheerful talk or tell you a story or entertain you in some way. So that was the bargain on which the first liberal academy was founded. And this burgeoned very rapidly, because a lot of people in Indian society realized that it was more fun to get a free lunch and then become enlightened than it was to fight in the army, to bear 15 children, to wash all the dishes, to do all the other things that they had to do. And of course, he didn't accept people who were just trying to get out of work. They had a few tests, you know, and criteria. But it still grew very, very rapidly. And actually, his former wife, who was almost the last person to convert to this new insight, because she was so mad with him when he left her and their son, when the son was newborn, that she just, you know, she was really bugged. But finally, she herself, when she met him, and when the son met him, the son just walked near his body, and when the shadow of the Buddha fell on, the son actually came to play a cruel joke on the Buddha, because the mother said, okay, go see your dad, when he finally went back to his home kingdom, and ask him for your inheritance, she said. And of course, that was cruel, because he was penniless, you see. So the son was a little nervous about it. He went to see the glorious Buddha, his father. He said, "Dad, I'm your son Rahula." And he was around 20 at that time. He said, "Mom says I should come and get my inheritance." So Buddha just said, "Ehi bhikkhu, come here, seeker." And then the son walked near to him. And then when the son walked into his shadow, the son achieved enlightenment. Total and perfect freedom from suffering and total insight in nirvana, actually. So then Buddha said, "How's that?" He said, "That's all right, Eureka, you know, it's great." And and apparently somehow when you have the experience of freedom and enlightenment, all of the struggles and the travails of getting there seem to sort of dissolve, because it's a kind of strange experience where once you have it, once you experience it, you realize that you always did have it. And that you were just distracting yourself from an awareness of it in a certain way. It's hard to explain, but they say anyway that it's because it's not something that you newly create. It's coming to an awareness of what is uncreated, what has always been there, what is the ground reality of the universe, and sort of becoming one with that reality and embracing that in your experience and feeling embodied in that ultimate reality and therefore finally stable and secure. Without that embodiment and stability and security, eradicating your ability to responsibly and lovingly and tenderly interact with beings in the world. So then this Sangha grew and created this alternative society in Indian society. And within a couple of centuries, the emperors even were coming around to funding big institutions like Trinity colleges all over the place. And the Sangha, the community. But the reason I don't like to tell college presidents is, of course, the faculty worked without salary. See, that's why it was so cheap to run the place. And they could spread them so well. But I hate college presidents to get that idea. So anyway, it grew enormously in India, and it emphasized in its first 500 years in India the principle of the individual using their precious life to achieve freedom from suffering and achieve enlightenment. And so it was monastic, and main emphasis was monastic. And the monastic element was crucially important. And I'm an ex-monk, and therefore Dalai Lama laughs at my way of presenting Buddhist history, or the history of, which is not just Buddhist history, actually the history of the planet, because I had a kind of eureka experience of my own 10 or 15 years after having ceased being a monk, that actually the monastic institution is the only institution in human history that has effectively, sometimes, protected the individual against the militaristic power of the state, East and West, irrespective of what religion it involved with. The sort of coercive, authoritarian, collectivist, and militaristic power of the state, the individual family has never been able to stand against it. Throughout history, the state has always submerged the family, killed them off, threatened to kill the children, and therefore they always control them. But monastics get to a certain macho level of sort of counter-military militancy, where at different times in history they have been managed to protect individuals from the state, and they have been a break on the totalistic power of the state wherever they have existed. And I was shocked to rediscover that, because I thought somehow it was something useful in the past, but we don't need it now, you know, since I'm an ex-monk. But you can read that in my Inner Revolution book, my thesis about monasticism, which is kind of a sociological and historical thesis. And I have a lot of detractors and a lot of debates still to go through with it. But I think it actually is correct, actually, and valid. Obviously, I do. And I'm ready to argue with anybody about it, too. I got the insight from answering the challenge of a Columbia sociologist before I worked at Columbia, who said, you know, who was chiding the peace movement, although he himself was a peacenik, a sort of Chomsky-ish type. And he was saying, "You guys, you go and do a protest once every 2 years, you know, you put some flowers in some gun barrels, you think you've done a great thing, and then you go back to your day job." And then the war movement, they go back to their paid salary jobs in the war industries and in the military. And then, therefore, where's your institution, not just as an individual for the occasional protesting, the occasional outrage, but where's your institution that is a peace movement that is there all the time to stop the war movement, or to balance it, or even put a brake on it, on its momentum? And then I was shocked by that, I remember, and I thought and thought and looked, and where is it? Where is it? Where is it? In history. Anywhere. The institution. Then I realized, you know, and then you think of, well, okay, we'll get a foundation, and then we'll pay, the foundation will be as big as the Pentagon in the United States, and we'll have to have $100,000 salaries for everybody in the... And forget it, right? Trillions it would take to build a counter institution like that. And then I suddenly realized, wait a minute, Of course, they had such an institution at different times in history. And you didn't have to have trillions because the people did it for nothing. But they were soldiers of peace, actually. They were ready to live and die for Christ or Buddha for peace. And they wouldn't fight. And they would stand against soldiers and swords with this sort of vision of a spiritual thing that gave them power, fearlessness of life and death, just equal and opposite to, and perhaps even more powerful than, finally, the fearlessness of life and death that the soldier gets jacked up into based on hatred. But anyway, that was, but it's nice to clap, thank you, and not me, because I'm an ex-monk, but for all the many thousands and millions of monks throughout history who did bring peace for little periods of time and created a little bit of asylums in different history, in different societies, East and West, never mind which religious ideology. They do deserve that applause, but then, by discovering this was not a comforting discovery, as you'll see when you read my Inner Revolution, because when you look at today, there is monasticism is effectively destroyed on the planet. And, hey, lo and behold, the counter-institution to monasticism, militarism, is totally in charge of the treasure of the planet, basically. The major investment of everybody in the planet is militarism. Even poor countries that can't feed people, that can't prevent their diseases, they're buying these weapons from Southern California. We are selling them the weapons, our people, madly and wildly, hand over fist. So where would be the monastic counter? Where would it come from? How could it work? It seems very difficult, actually. How do I really do it, you know? And then I'm an ex-monk, so I'm not helping, except pointing out the difficulty, you know? So anyway, so then this, the first 500 years was emphasizing that in India, and it became, was tremendously successful in India, and it helped calm down the sort of imperial quest in India. And, you know, the Emperor Ashoka, who did at least legendarily and apparently become a Buddhist after a certain level of conquest, this is an emperor whose grandfather destroyed the armies of Alexander the Great and beat him back from India. So they were not peaceniks, these Indians at this time. But anyway, this emperor, he became peaceful, and he did not do like Hannibal and attack the Iran and attack the Mediterranean. He spread the Buddhism. He spread this monastic institutional ethic in his country, in his empire, which was the huge, wealthiest empire in the world at the time, the Empire of India. And then once he had done that, about 500 years after the Buddha's time, there was a big emphasis, then this monastic institution was secure, and India was more developed and refined, and people had become a bit more gentle and somewhat less militaristic. And then it became safe and appropriate to develop a more powerful social ethic. And the Mahayana Buddhism arose, interestingly and auspiciously, very much around the time of Christ in West Asia. And it arose on a very strong gospel of love and compassion and universal, called the Mahayana, the universal vehicle of love and compassion, and transform the world into a Buddha land, as they would say, and bring everyone up into, you know, and love all beings, make them happy, etc. And so the emphasis was not only on your own liberation through monasticism into enlightenment, but it was on transforming the world into an enlightened realm. And that had its run for about 500 years. Although it didn't crush the monastic, it increased the monastic more, because it used it as it was one of its important methods. So it was not anti the monastic, actually, as it's been wrongly presented sometimes. It was building on top of the monastic. So then that happened, and then after 500 years, this third wave came, which scholars up until now have mainly considered a kind of terrible degeneration, which is called the wave of Tantra. There's a term called Tantra or Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle, the thunderbolt vehicle. I call it the apocalyptic vehicle, because it's a level of where the people don't want to just develop the society into some far-off future utopia, but they want to transform things here and now in a more apocalyptic manner. They want to see the diamond-like, compassionate energy of the strong force of the atoms in there, suffusing their being and suffusing their neighborhoods and suffusing nature now. And so therefore it has a kind of very powerful depth psychology of really going into the unconscious and rooting out the instinctual traces of evil, hatred, lust, anger, ignorance, and doing it in a very immediate way. And the people who do it are very amazing, kind of Walt Whitman-esque type of characters. Actually, my kids in Amherst once in a class fooled me by bringing in, said that they had been looking in the library and they'd found this old book of Saraha, one of the great Siddhas. you know, who was one of these great adepts, these great tantrics of this second half of the first millennium of the Common Era in India. And they said, "We found this, Professor Thurman. Wonder what you think of it." And they started reading me Leaves of Grass. And I didn't recognize it. I hadn't been reading English literature been reading Tibetan books for 20 years. And hadn't had time to get back and enjoy the great classics like that. And I said, "Oh, that sounds good." And they were so happy. It went around for weeks. You know, I thought, you know, they found a new translation of an Indian Siddha, but they were just basically reading me Whitman, you know. They were so happy with that one. As was I. Then I've spent more time on Whitman since then. Anyway, so this is then the 500-year period, 500 approximately. These are very rough things in India that happened. And by the end of this time in India, and already long before that, actually, India had become quite transformed as a society in many respects. But the most important respects of its transformation was that it had really lost its sort of martial vigor and martial power in a way. It was no longer such a feared, you know, elephant cavalry type of country. And therefore it was easy prey to the Turkic and Iranian invasions and Islamic invasions of the end of the first millennium, which did completely change the whole landscape of India and in fact wiped out the Buddhist universities, monastic universities, totally. From around 800 of the Common Era to around 1200, 1300, they just exterminated from one end of India to the other this immense influence of this liberating institution that had become central, actually, in Indian society. And the Indian historians of the modern period so much are aware of that, in a way, subliminally, although they wouldn't, that thesis would not be acceptable to many of them at first. But yet you can see that they're aware of it because they blame Buddhism for India becoming conquered by the West, actually. And they blame monasticism and asceticism, and they say that if we'd stayed with our Vedic ways, our old Indian tribal ways, we would have never succumbed like that, you see. And in a way, it is true that this sort of pacification process that Buddhism attempts to instill in a population by making them enlightened and more peaceful and monasticized, it does make them more vulnerable. Just like the individual who becomes enlightened and no longer is, "I'm absolute, and therefore get out of my face," they become more vulnerable, and in fact they can be put upon to some degree by people if they are careful. For example, in Buddhist texts that are teaching altruism and generosity, and they talk about great deeds of great heroic bodhisattvas in the past who fed themselves to wild animals or who gave their lives for this or that thing. They have these little caveats in the stories. They say, "Now don't rush out and do that. Don't rush out and feed the first tiger. It might be better to found it Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Tigers. After all, tiger will munch you down and be hungry tomorrow, you know. And you might use your, even though it's great that you have the nice, lovely idea to give yourself, it might be better to just cultivate that openness of mind without just throwing away your human life on the first tiger you meet, and then developing even wisdom and other kinds of higher faculties." And the fact that they have those caveats in the Buddhist books indicates that in that time in those societies, people really would act on these things. People would really develop these virtues. People would become what I call cool heroes and heroines, meaning they would develop the ability to offer themselves with the kind of heroism we associate only with military valor and in military heat, heat of hatred, that is, you know, and develop the courage to do that in a loving and cool and gentle way for some gentle purpose, not to destroy somebody, which I believe is a basic human ability that people in militaristic societies such as our own are systematically conditioned to believe it is impossible. They believe you can only train human being to be self-sacrificing out of hatred. And therefore, because the military is the only people who do train people to become self-sacrificing. And therefore, the military develop that sort of special power in people, in their military forces, and therefore they domineer the rest of us and frighten us and ramble us to death, movie after movie, you know, and propaganda after propaganda about it. But anyway, in India, it seemed that the opposite was happening, so by the end, they became like that. Now, luckily, at the end of that time, starting around the 8th century, 7th century, 8th century of the Common Era, some wise persons in India began to look for a hideout when they started realizing what might be coming. And because apparently they were enlightened enough at least to have a certain prescience about the flow and tides and ebbs and flows of the tides of people, and foresaw perhaps that this sort of gentrified India with its ragas and its vegetarianism and its mangoes and its like pleasant climate and its goddesses and so forth, that it might be a little vulnerable to a few camel drivers, you know, and sort of nasty, sort of like tough and rough types and insensitive types who might show up. So they looked up at one bunch of rough and tough and sensitive types and they saw the Tibetans. And at that time, the Tibetans were like Genghis Khan's people. They had a huge empire in Central Asia. They conquered down into Bengal, into Nepal. They conquered China a couple of times during the Tang Dynasty. The Tang Dynasty paid tribute to the Tibetans to keep them away, actually. Far from being owners of Tibet, the Tibetans conquered China a couple of times. They conquered the whole Silk Route. They fought to a standstill Harun al-Rashid, the Caliph of Baghdad, in these centuries. So they were very tough people. But in a way, they also, luckily for their neighbors, unlike Genghis Khan, they came from this country, this amazing high plateau that is average of 15,000 feet. And apparently when you grow up at 15,000 feet with the sort of slightly mellow feelings that, you know, oxygen deprivation does to your brain, you apparently don't feel like settling down in low-altitude Beijing or low-altitude Calcutta or low-altitude wherever it is. So even though you may raid and loot and pillage and conquer, you want to go back up to the cool highlands. And so they never wanted to settle. They reached maximum expansion around this time. And a king, an emperor of theirs, said, well, now we're at maximum expansion, this sort of war confederacy tribal trip that we're doing here, war gods and so on, and sacrifices and the wild tribal business, is kind of boring. And also, it's not a good ethic on which to have a peaceful internal existence, because people are always vying with each other, and I'll even have to worry about these generals coming back from battles and toppling me. So what would be a nice universal peaceful ethic? And he looked around the world and his neighboring kingdoms, and he saw the glory of the Pala dynasty and the post-Gupta dynasties in India. He saw the glory of the Tang dynasty he saw the glory of Central Asia. And all of that was Buddhism, Buddhist art, Buddhist temples, Buddhist monks, Buddhist literature, Buddhist everything. So he began to import it. And then the masters of the Buddhist institution began to send it up to Tibet. But here, unlike in the case of India, there wasn't three waves of sort of 500-year, breakers, rolling in. All three waves hit Tibet at once. Bam, monasticism, messianism of love and compassion, and apocalypticism of esoteric, diamond thunderbolt type of energy. And so the Tibetans was much quicker in a way their cycle, you could say. So from around 650 of the Common Era, when they began and built the first major temple by an emperor, against the will of the nobles, against the will of the warlords, against the will of the people, they thought, this is some weird thing, this isn't our tribal deity, this isn't our war god, why is he building this thing? And these weird Buddhas, where are they coming from? He kind of had to force them. And for a couple hundred years, the Im dynasty kind of pushed this down, top down on the people who were used to a much more violent, warlike way. After 1,000 years, by 1650, whatever people want to say about the imperfections of Tibet, Tibet did give up its militarism sort of more or less finally. And from 1650 to 1950, during the time of what I call modern Tibet, Tibet actually basically had no army. It was basically demilitarized. That doesn't mean, and that, people will say, oh, you're saying Tibet was so perfectly peaceful. Naive people will say that, falsely. I'm not saying that. There was plenty of wife beating. There was plenty, a bit of husband beating, I think, sometimes. There was a lot of, like, even rough monks. They had a couple of monks they called toughy monks, who used to have monk Olympics and wrestle, and they were like World Wrestling Federation. They were thug-like monks. I mean, there's lots of imperfections, but still the sociological fact remains that the government was composed by a certain type of coalition between monastics and the former nobles. And this was done by the monastics because they had the power, and they actually expropriated the private armies from the nobles, who had been making like a couple of centuries of war before that in the 15th and 16th centuries. An early part of the 17th century, and they basically took away all the armies from the nobles, they took away the feudal powers from those nobles, and they created a monastic government where the head of the government was a monk, which was something unique in Buddhist history and only happened there. And if you see it in terms of my thesis and dialectic of the competition throughout the history of Asian societies and also Western and Christian societies particularly, which is the other great monastic religion, That monastic and military were always vying for resources and power and prestige in societies. And when the military would co-opt the monastic, then the country would become head for war. And when the monastic would create an asylum against the military, there might be periods of peace. And you can sort of see that if you look through history. And you don't be fooled by, you know, precisely when sometimes monks go to war, when the monastic power, the shogun or the warlords, you know, co-opt the monastics, and then they start making war, then that's the loss of the true essence of the monastic, if you follow me. And so Tibet is the only case in the 17th century where this struggle between the warlords and the monastics was decided in favor of the monastics. And since that time until 1950, 85% of the national treasure, at least, the overt one, the amount that actually came through the government from taxes and then sent back out in distributions, went to support monastic education, monastic universities. They had a country that it became a type of society that I call a mass monastic society, not the dualistic medieval type of monastic society where there's a little bit of monasticism and mainly a bunch of knights clanking around in armor, but one where there's like so many monks it's ridiculous, and nuns, that it's really ridiculous. And there's really no more knights, basically. And during that whole time, any time there was a little bit of incursion into Tibet or a little problem, the Tibetans had to invite in some warlord from outside, the Manchu emperor or some Mongol Khan, to come and get rid of this other problem because they just didn't have the military resources to deal with it. And that is an undeniable sociological fact, and that isn't romanticizing Tibet, that is reporting a fact. And a great achievement of a society that 1,000 years before that had been a Genghis Khan-like, you know, a Pentagon America-like society. In 1,000 years, they switched and demilitarized, basically. And therefore, in the same as India, and even more poignantly as we are seeing today, became vulnerable. And for some years, the lamas, by the prestige and by the fact that the powerful neighbors were Buddhist, Mongol kings and Manchu emperors, they were able to be protected from outside whenever any other person would come against them. But then this broke down in the modern period where there were the communists, materialists in China, and then the British. And they couldn't protect them, you know, they didn't believe in they didn't honor those lamas, they didn't care about Buddhism, so then they did destroy the place. And the other thing that in between there that also is an amazing event that they did is that the Tibetans exported this particular type of mass monastic lifestyle, they exported it to the Mongols, who had been Genghis Khan in the second millennium, right? Genghis Khan's empires in the 13th and 14th centuries, 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries, biggest empire in human history without any machinery except bows and arrows and horses. Much bigger, though, than the British Empire or any other empire or the Russian Empire. And they made the Mongols vulnerable and peaceful, too, although also funky, too, funky. Not perfect, not Shangri-La, but peaceful, nevertheless. The basic, you know, Mongol, I used to work carpentry in New Jersey with different Mongolians. And these are these guys who, when they come to the American diet, they're like 6 feet tall and 6 feet wide and 6 feet thick. And I would nail and hammer them and their hand would go whistling by my head with a 22-ounce hammer hitting in a 22-penny nail in one stroke. As in some rafter framing things, I'd be nailing, tap, 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 tap. And I'd be thinking, thank you, Buddha, Genghis Khan is like hitting nails with building a Buddhist temple with me. Thanks, Buddha, thanks, Tibetan lamas. So that's kind of the history, okay? Now we turn to the spiritual path itself and the sort of vision of life that these people are doing is their sort of the main sort of backbone thing. Not that everyone in Tibet, of course, does that, but many aspects, as you'll see when I go through it, are very part and parcel of many of the strange phenomena of Tibetan civilization that people are so amazed by and so puzzled by, and result in this incredible devoutness that people observe in the Tibetans. Even though they may be ignorant, even a bandit, even a guy will come and rob you, and maybe he'll kill you, but we won't use that example because then you couldn't observe him afterwards, but rob you, and then he'll go to the temple and start praying and like bowing and like worrying about it. But he just robbed you too. So he's not quite, you know, realized it, but he's still devout, you know. He's worried about that sin he just committed and is going to commit tomorrow. So in between, he tries to accumulate a little virtue, you know. So now the path to enlightenment is sort of an ancient thing in Buddhism, but the Tibetans kind of streamlined it into what they called the Jangchu Lamje Rinpa, what's called Lam Rim, the stages of the path of enlightenment teaching. And it's really very simple. It has three main divisions. And these three main divisions, the first one is called renunciation, or I like to say transcendent renunciation. The second is called the spirit of enlightenment, of love and compassion for all beings, and that really is spirituality in a way for the Buddhists. And the third is love and compassion, as I mean. And the third is the wisdom of selflessness of persons and things, it's called, or the wisdom of the relationality of ultimate reality, of universal reality, something like that. Basically wisdom, knowledge of the nature of reality. So those are the three main divisions of the path. And the path begins by, first thing that the path begins with, the first theme in the path, other than a kind of appreciation of the teaching and the teacher, which of course is a kind of first theme, but the real first theme that you really dwell upon and you really meditate will, I think, surprise you all. It is how great this human life is. What a marvelous thing is a human, is where it begins. Because the reason that we waste our lives and you waste your time making widgets or making money, which is equally useless, past a certain point. I mean, you gotta eat, and you gotta like feed and pay tuition, etc. But then there's billions and zillions, billions and zillions and things that people like waste their time with. That's total waste. They couldn't even eat it all if they tried to eat the actual money itself, or if they tried to, you know, like someone like Ted Turner or Soros. I mean, they couldn't even probably burn it all if they had a constant bonfire going with $100 bills between now and doomsday. But then now, when they keel over with a heart attack or the pacemaker fails, you know. And so, but the reason why we do that is that we don't respect ourselves. The reason why we allow ourselves to be enslaved by this or that prejudice or hatred or ideology or staring mindlessly at some T-tube or something is that we don't respect our own time. Because we feel, well, what are we going to really do with life? I mean, what, we're just like us, you know. We go to do some work, then we eat as long as everything's okay. We defend ourselves, then we're going to die. And what else is there to do type of thing, you know. Now, this luckily is a Catholic institution, but that is the kind of, you know, post-Protestant secularist idea that life is meaningless that we really live with. But from the Tibetan point of view, our basic real crippling ideological problem is that we do not think we will have a future life. Because some of you are religious, some of you are Catholics and are religious, and you might make a donation to the church. You might think that you should like prepare for the angels or St. Peter. We were making St. Peter's jokes at dinner. You might want to get prepared to get through those pearly gates, you know, have the right credit card or security clearance, you know, handprint, you know. But relatively very few. And even if we have a belief that there is such a thing as an afterlife because we're of our religious affiliation, we don't really live for that. We don't put the same oomph of that we put into our pension, our retirement plan. Are like a Florida getaway. That's what we know we're going to have that, or we think we might die before we get to enjoy that, of course, if we overwork. But we think we're going to have that, so we really live, we plan for this life. We only plan for this life. We are brought up in a culture that thinks that life is meaningless and random, even that life is an illusion. Because it's just the wetware, like, flopping around, you know? The wetware flops, and a little electric signal goes, and you didn't take the right Prozac, so suddenly you think that you're there. But really, you're not. As any microbiologist, neuropsychologist, cognitive scientist at MIT will tell you, you're not really there. You're just kind of like a berserk computer that doesn't know how to run right. And the fact that you're there is just an accident. It's just some atoms went bloop and a selfish gene went blop and that's it, and you're here. And no matter how great you are and how, if you become enlightened, you're going to die and you're going to be nothing. Even if you're so good, you give yourself to all beings, you're going to die and you're going to be nothing. And the selfish slob who goes and robs everybody is also going to die and going to be nothing. So what's the point in anything? And this is how our people grow up. So therefore, you know, if you blew up the whole planet, that everyone would quickly be nothing. And then never mind, you know. So let's like put some more nuclear power plants on top of the San Andreas Fault and let's forget the ozone layer. Who cares? We're all going to be nothing, so it all doesn't matter. Isn't this our sickness? This, from the Buddhist point of view, is spiritually crippling. And the Tibetan path begins with overcoming this delusion, which is I want to tell you a story. I know someone is a medical doctor, a very, very important neuro-whatever in New York. But I'm not going to mention the name. But This guy is like really has a lot of hardware, so you know he's important. A lot of funds, billions, millions go through that office. And we were talking about maybe some sort of dialogue, and maybe he was hoping to get some, stick some things into some Tibetan yogis. That was his real ultimate goal. But anyway, he was talking with me. And in the process, at one point, I mentioned something about, well, it'd be interesting to think of what a difference it makes in the lives of these people that they think they might have a future life. They have a sense of being connected to the causality of their actions and the consequences of their actions beyond even the death in this life. It might be interesting to think of that. And I wasn't saying that, you know, that it might be so. I wasn't at all saying that. I knew the guy. I was just saying, you know, this, we have to think of what the people have in their minds when we go and measure, you know, see if that makes a difference. And he just jumped up all nervously, you know, don't even say it in this building. That's primitive, old-fashioned. Don't say such a thing. He said, he was looking around in case a colleague overheard he was talking with such a person. You know? And he said, there's nothing happens after death. We know that. We've discovered it. We've proved it. We've found it. It is established beyond a doubt. He said, and I said, oh, okay. I said, I'm an American too, you know. I teach at Columbia. Like, relax. I was just talking about some Tibetan. I backed away, you know, because it was so upset, you know. And then I went, and then 2 days later, I almost got arrested by my taxi driver going somewhere to a meeting because I just began to laugh uncontrollably. Because I suddenly realized from this dialogue 2 days earlier, this guy was going around in his life thinking that you can find nothing. You can prove nothing. You can verify nothing. You can get a report about nothing. And that is an incontrovertible fact. Nothing is a controvertible fact. Do you realize what an act of imagination that is? A failure of knowing of what the words that the man was saying mean? Nothing is nothing. It's the one thing nobody could ever find, could ever prove, could ever discover, could ever enter. It is simply nothing. It is not a place. It is not a dark hole. It is not a deep sleep. Therefore, it's the one thing in the universe that no one has ever found. And no one could ever prove existed. And in fact, the imagination that it could exist is completely a bit of, like, mental projection. Obviously, because it's nothing. It's the word for what is not there. So who's going to enter it and go to sleep in it? We're crying out loud. Do you get the point? The person who commits suicide because they're embarrassed over losing their stock market fortune is thinking they're going to go deeper than a deep sleep and never wake up to face this bankruptcy. They are having, therefore, in the mind is imprisoned by a picture of a dark space of total anesthesia, a permanent escape, a kind of instant nirvana by just messing with the wetware, with a quick whatever. Right? So they're going right into that imagination of nothing. They think, and of course, they're going to get nowhere. And they're going to find themselves in a worse than bankrupt state in the other life. St. Peter's going to ask for a little toll payment. They're going to have nothing. Not going to even have a brain left. They're just walking around with a hole in their head. And probably a big headache in the between state. As we say it, as we call it in Tibet. Anyway, so now, I'm trying to teach the first theme of the Buddhist path. So the first theme of the Buddhist path is to cure this childish absolutization of nothingness, thinking that we can be disconnected from anything. Buddha was celebrated once by what famous verse that he was the discoverer of causation, and that if every cause has an effect, and everything comes from a cause, and also, therefore, how to intervene in a causal thing if it's unpleasant, to make it pleasant. And this was his great achievement, was discovering causation in that civilization. Sound familiar? Like a little the Greek business, doesn't it? But his causation that was important to him was mental causation, of course, spiritual causation, what caused negative spiritual and mental and emotional states. And the causation that caused good mental and emotional and spiritual states, that was what he thought was the more important causation, which is not the same as the Greek thing. The Greeks went into the outer thing, as we are stuck in the outer thing. But this is the key thing to be cured of at the first den in the Tibetan path, in the beginning of the path, is to accept, to develop the maturity. Even though we still have subliminal and subconscious absolutist and escapist tendencies in our hearts and wish to sort of hide and withdraw from reality and from life and from interconnectedness, but to acknowledge the reality of interconnectedness to the sufficient degree that we feel we are embedded in an evolutionary process that is beginningless, as far as we know. And I don't think that's a big contradiction from, you know, from Christianity or from theistic things that say everything began with God, because God is beginningless. So when it began with God, it's just like saying began from beginninglessness, which is just what the Buddhists say. They just don't personalize it. They say it's beginningless. That's how they solve the chicken and the egg. Did God first make an egg or a chicken? God knew all about chickens and eggs beginninglessly, infinitely into the past, and therefore that you have to be prepared to be a part of an evolution infinitely into the future. Once this becomes accepted in a certain way, once you feel plugged in like that, then you have a certain type of motivation, you have a meaning in life. And what is the meaning? Not to let this infinite consequentiality of all your thoughts, words, and deeds go in a negative direction. Even selfishly, you have that motive then. Just like we don't want to ruin our lives and have no pension and have no insurance and have no this and have no that and wreck our lungs and die horribly and penniless and abandoned. So we therefore take precautions to see to it that we have a decent future. So you want to have a decent future all the way. This is the beginning of spiritual practice in the Buddhist Tibetan path. And this is why Tibetans will recite mantras day and night when they retire. They will bow to images. They will do every kind of virtuous thing to build up positive karmic or evolutionary accumulation of merit and wisdom. And then, of course, within that framework, by the way, and this is now coming back to the first theme, the human embodiment that we now have is something magnificent, and it is not something that just popped out of a seed by accident. Each one of us who is a human being has developed and evolved from lesser life forms to become human with our own effort. We have been interacting with others. We have been beholden to them. Their gods also have been involved. But we ourselves also have made choices. When we were a crocodile, we like let one mommy zebra go one day. We didn't eat every zebra that jumped into that. We didn't eat ones that we didn't need. We were the more altruistic crocodile. And then we were reborn as one that had like a swiveling eye, you know, or had a smaller jaw so we could begin to talk. Like, how can you talk with such teeth, you know? Really? I don't know what kind of noises they make, actually. But in order to develop the kind of human mouth that can talk, you have to like do a lot less chewing. And you can't, who would talk to you with you coming at them with a mouth like that anyway? They'd be smart to run away. So the point is, each one of us has individually evolved from different life forms, and the form that we have now, therefore, in a way, is our own earning. And the particular form that we have where there intrudes upon our awareness something different than just grab what's in front of you, survive, just jump on the next thing, gulp the next air, grab the next food, and it is, what am I? Who am I? What is this thing? What could I do? What is the meaning of this? We are this amazing being that can think about itself. We have had the notion of liberty enter into our idea. We have encountered, directly or indirectly through history, Buddhas, beings, bodhisattvas, saints, beings who have transcended the ordinary instinctual selfish drive. And we realize that there is a higher way of being than just selfishly grabbing for leaping on whatever's in front of us. This is called having the special, precious jewel of a human embodiment endowed with liberty and opportunity, and it's very carefully specified. And the first thing, therefore, you have to do, therefore, if you have such a thing, imagine you, your brain, your heart, your soul is like a Stradivarius. It's like a fantastic piano, some incredible artistic thing with which you can make the most amazing creations. And you can even find out what you are, for sure. And liberate yourself from being driven by your unconscious or your instincts.